Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we are answering your listener questions.
Yeah, Joel, as always, we are getting into some questions from the listeners. We've got five of them to run through, and on this episode, we're going to talk about getting overpaid, what to do about that when that does happen.
Although that terrible, unfortunate event.
I don't know if that's ever happened to me, personally.
No, it hasn't to me either.
But we're going to cover a question on IRS debt, and we also have a question about an ESPP, which is an employee stock purchase plan. That is something I'm pretty sure, man, that we have never talked about on this show before, so I am excited to launch into that. It's something that I've never had the opportunity to take advantage of. What about you?
Wait, you mean your photography business hasn't gone public yet?
It does, actually, tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah, right. So hold on tight. You want to get in on that IPO, right?
Yeah. Actually, it's an interesting point. There have been a lot of IPOs lately, and if you look at kind of how they typically go, it's usually like just a sinking ship, and so many folks get so excited about an IPO, and they're like, I want to buy that stock.
Please. That was you with WeWork.
Right. Typically a bad move.
All of your money is now gone.
Yeah. wait till things settle out and then consider buying if you're really that interested. But on the same note, buying individual stocks, not a great move, but that's a topic for another day.
Another day. Yeah. But you've got some news for us. You want to share with our listeners a recent purchase you made?
Yeah. So, okay. I'm full old man at this point because we bought a minivan.
Woo!
I know. Yeah.
Minivan life!
So I'm thinking about getting a bumper sticker that says I used to be cool and putting it on the back of the minivan.
No, see, that's just not cool because that's also what somebody in your position might do.
That's true.
Instead, just buy like a sweet motorcycle or something like that just to counterbalance it.
Okay, there you go.
Like, you want to overcompensate like very obviously with what you're dealing with there.
All right, I can make that happen. But yeah, so we did. We recently bought a minivan. It turns out kind of that we needed a little more space now that we have a third kiddo, and we decided to go in that direction. And I just wanted to let folks know that the minivan that we bought was a 2006 and it cost $5,000.
Oh, six.
Yeah.
That makes it 14 years old.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is awesome.
I think sometimes, man, when we talk about buying a used car, a lot of people assume that even to buy anything reliable, you have to buy something that was...
Two years old.
Yeah, 2 or 3 years old. And at that point in time, you know what? Still, the car has 60% of its value left to depreciate. Whereas when you're buying something that's a 2006, man, even if I sell it 5 years from now, I'm going to lose what? At most $1,500. And so I just wanted to encourage people that you can find good, older, used vehicles, and you can put a lot more miles on them. And really what you're avoiding is the biggest cost when it comes to owning a car, and that's depreciation. It's not the cost of gas. It's not the cost of insurance. It is truly the cost of depreciation. That's the biggest thing that you're facing. And so, yeah, this car, man, it had been looked over by a mechanic. I knew its history really, really well. So I felt super comfortable buying this van. And I have a really, really good feeling that it's going to last us for a bunch of years to come.
Well, man, I'm just going to say that that is impressive. Getting a vehicle that old, like you said, financially, an amazing decision. Although, we'll see if you're being frugal or cheap, if it ends up crapping out on you maybe in 100,000 miles. Well, everything kind of goes out on you 100,000 miles, right? Like, you got to put some money into any vehicle.
Sure.
When you drive it for long enough.
And that was the thing. Like, I talked to the owner. I knew kind of what had been done to it, you know, and a couple of the major things that tend to go wrong, you need to replace brake pads and rotors. You need to replace timing belt and water pump. Those things have been done. And there were other things that had been done to it as well. A new AC compressor, like all these things that had been...
Got a new HVAC for that van.
Right. Yeah.
Nice.
All these things that typically go wrong and cost a lot of money. It had really good tires. So there are all these expenses that it looks like, I mean, I know that, you know, I'm planning for certain expenses, right? That's going to be a line item in my budget, but you know what? I'm not planning on spending a whole lot more than I would have on a car 5 or 6 years newer because this one has been taken care of so well.
You know? Nice, man. Well, I wanted to share a little note too. The average new car buyer spends over $550 every month.
Wow.
In payments. That is kind of mind-boggling, because you think about how much car you could get if you were just to save that money up instead of actually making payments and paying interest. And dude, a big reason for that is because so much of our life is on this model where we just pay by things monthly.
Yeah.
So many things are moving to a subscription basis. And I think it's rewiring how we think about our expenses. And we think that this is something that I'm just budgeting for this month. And we don't take into account that total cost of ownership. We don't think about depreciation. We're not thinking about how much we're actually going to spend on that vehicle versus if we were to have just paid for that in cash, and let alone versus if we would have purchased an older vehicle in cash. And so, Joel, I think this is a great lesson and a good challenge for folks, because we're not saying that you have to purchase a 14-year-old vehicle, but at the same time, we don't want you purchasing a brand new vehicle, or even maybe that 2-year-old vehicle. Like, there's plenty of vehicles that are 3, 4, 5 years old, all the way up until they're 14 or 15.
Yeah.
Like your new sweet ride.
Right. Yeah. And I think, again, Matt, like, so much of this is kind of what you value the most personally. Some people value buying a new car. And who are we to say that that's a terrible idea?
Like, right. Exactly.
There are financial things to be considered. And there are some decent reasons for buying a new vehicle. You and I, that's not what we do, right? Yeah. That's not what we value. And I wanted to say, like, ultimately, that's...
Well, even between you and me, like, I think we value vehicles slightly different, right?
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
On our end, we've got one vehicle. And so that's part of our reasoning, because we think, all right, we've only got one vehicle. But I think even if we had 2 vehicles, I think we do value maybe having a slightly newer vehicle more than you guys. Because, like, with you think about it more from the standpoint of, like, will this get me to the store and will it get me back safely?
Well, yeah, I do. I mean, honestly, there were some other considerations in this, and there were some specific, you know, features that we were looking for when we bought this car, and it had those features. And so we were glad, but we knew that we can get those features in a 2006 car.
Right.
And if we can find the right one, and granted, it's hard. It's not like finding a needle in a haystack, but it can feel like that at times when you're looking for this car that has been incredibly well maintained from someone that just has cared for it well. But I want to say, like, the biggest consideration for me is, where do I want my money to go? And how do I want it to be working for me? And I just don't want to sink more of my money into a vehicle, at least at this point in my life. You know, maybe in 5 or 10 years, I'll feel a little bit differently. And after years and years of saving and investing a good chunk, maybe I'll feel a little more comfortable spending a little more on something like a car. I don't know if that'll ever change for me. I don't know if that shift is actually going to happen. But for now, I just don't value it, and I don't see myself allocating more money towards cars. So I was glad to buy a 2006 vehicle that is clean and nice and fits everything that we need.
Oh, please, dude. I've heard you talk about that that new V-Dub electric van. I don't know what they're calling it. The E-Vanagon or something like that?
The ID Buzz.
Is that what it's called?
I think so. At least that's what they're calling it now.
That'll be the vehicle you save up your money for, and it'll probably feel more like a splurge for you, because it may not necessarily be something that you need, but you might want it for sure at that point.
So I'm already planning ahead. It comes out in 2022, and then I'm going to wait five years for it to be...
I'll buy
it in 2027 probably.
Okay, so you keep saving up for that, and I'll keep saving up for the World Cup semifinals when one of those matches is at the Benz, and we will spend equivalent amounts of money. You will have a vehicle, and I will have an experience.
One night of
amazingness. Yeah.
Nice.
It all comes down to what you value, right?
Sure.
Like, that's what we're talking about here.
True, for sure. All right, Matt, let's get on to the beer that we're having on the show today. We're drinking Mexican Chocolate Yeti by Great Divide Brewing Company out of Denver, Colorado. Matt, I've been to their barrel aging facility. It is very lovely.
Is that the one that's downtown?
Yeah.
Well, then I've been there as well.
It's a really good spot. And their Yeti beers are just, I mean, a classic mainstay in the craft brewing scene at this point in time.
They've been around for a while, and they continue to innovate, which is what's amazing about Great Divide. They're kind of one of the old school 2.0 craft brewers on the scene, but they are continuing to do new and cool stuff. So they kind of are sliding into that 3.0 category as well in my book.
Yeah. They're staying strong, brewing good beer. Yeah. So let's talk about this one at the end of the episode.
You got it, man.
All right, man. Let's get to our listener questions. And by the way, if you are listening and you have a question for us, it's incredibly easy to submit your question. Just go to howtomoney.com/ask and follow the simple guidelines to submit your voice question so that we can hopefully take it on an upcoming episode. All right, Matt, let's get to the first one, which is about getting overpaid by your employer.
Hi, Matt and Joel. This is Trisha from Boston, Massachusetts. I love the podcast. I am reaching out today with more of a dilemma than a question about being overpaid wages. I work a full-time job at a nonprofit, and as a side gig, I thought I would start a part-time job as a part-time event staff for another nonprofit in the area. towards the end of my first month there, my full-time job got a little busier, so I cut back on some of those hours, and I noticed that the last paycheck for my part-time gig had come in and the amount wasn't correct. And instead of getting, you know, $200, I got $1,200. I reached out directly to the executive director who I had worked with, and he assured me that he would help fix it. You know, I offered to write a check. Flash forward, it's been about 2 to 3 months since I first pointed this out to him, and I've been following up, you know, pretty regularly via email, and I haven't really gotten an answer on how to fix this. Are there other common ways to pay this back? Should I just send in a check? I really don't like the extra money floating around in my account. So any insight or experience you have with this would be great. Thank you guys so much. I love the podcast.
Well, Joel, I think this is a very unique problem that Trisha has. Most nonprofits have the opposite problem, right? Like, they can't get people to give them money. And here we've got Trisha, and she's trying to give them back the money that they incorrectly paid her. And sounds like she's having a tough time.
Yeah. And honestly, another problem that happens at nonprofits is that employees just don't get paid enough to stay oftentimes. And so Trisha is getting paid quite handsomely for her work at this nonprofit, I would say.
She shouldn't have given up that side hustle.
Yeah, right. But yeah, man, let's get into it. I mean, I think there are some things that need to be considered if you do get overpaid by your employer. And specifically, Trisha, let's talk about the ethical ramifications of being overpaid by your employer first. I think you've done the right thing. You've notified your employer about being overpaid. So ethically, you're in a good position here. Typically, at some point, even if you don't, your employer will reach back out to you and say, you got overpaid. Now we have to start taking money out of your future paychecks. That's probably what's going to happen if you do get overpaid and you don't mention it. So it's better to be above board and try to pay that money back as quickly as possible. It's the right ethical thing to do. And then also, let's talk about legally, your employer has the right to recoup that money. Laws vary depending on the state that you live in, but the statute of limitations for overpayment of salary can vary anywhere from like 6 months to 6 years. And I've even heard that some states have over a 10-year statute of limitations. So check your local state law to be aware of how long they are legally able to require you to pay that money back. We covered the ethical framework, but also legally, if you're overpaid from your employer, you're required to pay that money back.
And so, Trisha, you're asking what you should do about it now. And our advice right now would be just to not worry about it. You've taken the steps. You've done the legwork to make every reasonable effort to notify them that they've messed up. You've followed up pretty regularly, it sounds like, by email to the director. Like, that puts you in the clear, especially considering that he's confirmed that he would help fix the error. There's not going to be any confusion, like, once this error is discovered and they try to remedy it, that you weren't trying to do the right thing. And so at this point, we'd say to just set that money aside in a high interest savings account, hopefully maybe where you have your emergency fund as well. But basically, you want to earmark it to go back to that nonprofit if or when they finally get that ball rolling and fix that on their end.
Yeah, Matt, I think the worst thing that could happen is to, you know, get overpaid, then spend the money, and then your company comes calling and they're like, hey, yeah, we overpaid you. We need that money back. And you're like, I don't have it. And so that's just a tough scenario to be in, both ethically and monetarily, right? You want to have that money at your disposal to be able to pay back the overpayment when and if they do come back at you. And then I think too, Trisha, the final ditch effort, and you mentioned it in your question, is if you do want to completely try and wash your hands of it, you should send them a check via certified mail and keep that record on your end. There's a chance that they still don't deposit that check, but now you've pretty much taken every effort in order to get that money back to them. And so if that's the case, they still don't take your money, they don't cash the check, well, you still need to keep it set aside, because the statute of limitations can be so long depending on what state you're in. More than anything, I would keep in contact with the director. Consider sending that check if you really want to go above and beyond and get that money paid back to that employer. I'm sorry. I know it's frustrating. I know it's annoying, like, to be sitting on a pile of money that you know you're going to have to send back at some point, and you're just kind of hoping they get their act together sooner rather than later, for sure.
Joel, on the note of free money, what's the most you've ever found? Not just change out in public, but like, what kind of bills have you found?
Probably like a $20 bill, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same here. I hit a stretch in my life after Kate and I got married where I think like 3 months in a row, I found a $20 bill. Different cities, different grocery stores, but it was always at a grocery store, and $20 bill on the ground in the parking lot. Like, what do you do in that situation? Because everybody wants to have some cash. I would kind of pick it up and look around, see if there's somebody that's like hustling back to try to like find some money, because it's easy to believe that somebody is, you know, has actually lost the money if they're looking like, I'm looking for a $20 bill. Like, where have you seen it? It's like, yeah, I just picked it up. But otherwise, man, that's money that can go towards that frozen pizza, right?
That's when you got to start asking those questions like, well, whose picture's on this $20 bill, huh? If it's yours, tell me some details about it.
I want some identifying features of that cash.
Yeah, what year was it printed in, huh?
But I always do feel a little bit weird anytime you get something like that that's not yours. But
especially if it's that big. If it's like, you know, a dime or a quarter, who cares? But yeah, when you're talking about finding a $20 bill, I'm like, well, somebody's probably missing that.
Yeah, you feel bad. And the whole time I'm in the grocery store, I'm kind of looking for somebody like that looks like they need money.
Sure, yeah.
Basically, it's like, is it him? Is it her? Like, did she drop it? But yeah, I don't know. Trisha, I say that because I identify with you and that feeling that you have something that isn't technically yours, but at the same time, you don't know how to get it back to them. And it sounds like you are taking all the right steps. So yeah, just keep it up.
Yeah. All right, Trisha, good luck. And we got some more questions, including we'll get to that question about IRS debt and what do you do when you've got money that you owe the IRS. We'll get to that right after the break.
All right, Joel, we're back from the break and we have a question now from a listener, and she has a question about converting a 401k. So let's hear it.
Hi, Joel and Matt. My name is Jamie. I'm from Hoboken, New Jersey. I love listening to your podcast. You guys got me to really start thinking about my money and how to save and spend better. My question is about rolling over a 401k into an IRA or a Roth IRA. I have about $20,000 vested in a Charles Schwab 401k from my previous employer. The expense ratios on my elections range from 0.02 to 0.57. It is also actively managed, which I was already planning to end to reduce fees. Should I roll this over into an IRA or a Roth IRA? I currently have a Roth IRA with Fidelity. What are the benefits of leaving it as is or rolling it over? Thanks so much for your help.
All right. That's awesome, Jamie. $20,000 in retirement already. That's fantastic. And you know what? Charles Schwab, well, they're a pretty great company to be doing business with. They have lots of low-cost investing options, and their customer service is really good too. But let's talk about specifically that conversion. And is it a good idea to convert your 401k to an IRA? Well, there's a lot to consider here. I think, Matt, let's quickly mention one potential downside of rolling over your 401k to an IRA is that you could lose access to some funds you might currently be able to invest in your employer's plan. This is a pretty minor downside, though, because the normal options available to everyone at Charles Schwab or at Fidelity, the two companies you do business with, Jamie, are great. So, Matt, I did want to mention this, though, because, for instance, inside my employee 401k plan, I have access to a target retirement fund that has lower expense fees than anyone I could get on the open market. So,
aren't you fancy?
So employers, just because of their size, they have this ability to be able to get funds that have lower expense ratios and offer those to their employees. So it's just kind of one of those things. It's not that big of a deal because, you know, with these low-cost companies, the expenses are already just incredibly low. We're talking about just a couple hundredths of a percent difference in expense.
Extremely small.
It is one of those things, and it's worth mentioning.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah. So, well, Jamie, you know, you're talking about rolling that 401k over. We think actually converting that to an IRA, it's a good idea. And we see no issues with keeping your money with Schwab either. It sounds like you're already aware of those high cost funds that are actively managed. So the fact that you are moving away from those expensive products, like, that is smart, and that's what you need to be doing. You'll be set with funds that have an expense ratio around 0.02%. But we would advise you to avoid the different funds that put you closer to 0.5% in costs.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with staying put and having that 401k with Schwab, as long as you're, you know, changing your fund choices to less expensive, widely diversified funds inside of that 401k with Schwab. But if you rolled it over into an IRA, that's not a bad move either. If you did want to move it all to Fidelity, let's say, and have all of your IRAs in one place, well, just know that Schwab does have a $50 fee for a full account transfer to a different trustee. But that's pretty minor in the grand scheme of things. It's not all that much. The benefit here is that you already have a Roth with Fidelity and you're familiar kind of with their ecosystem. Obviously, too, we've mentioned this before, Fidelity has those zero cost funds. So even though you've got the super cheap expense ratio with Schwab, you can't be free. And that's what Fidelity offers. So yeah, if you're going to do that, just know you're going to pay $50 for the ability to make it happen. But you know what? That's a good move, too.
And so we think the hardest part of your question might be the decision of whether or not you're going to roll into a Roth or a regular IRA. We would suggest rolling into a Roth if you have the money to pay taxes on those converted funds when you file your taxes. Tax rates are very low right now, so you might only owe $2,500 on that entire conversion. And then you'll never be taxed on that money again. For me, that makes me very happy to know that this is something that you have. And then moving forward, that is just such a strong position to be in. And plus, you already have a Roth, so you can put that money there in that Roth there with Fidelity. If you don't have the cash, however, on hand to pay the taxes on that conversion, you can open up a traditional IRA with Fidelity as well and put it there. In this case, you would have both pre-tax money in your retirement as well as some post-tax. So that allows you to diversify the tax structure on your retirement accounts. It basically diversifies that tax liability.
Yeah, man. I think you made a good point, though, Matt, that when we're talking about current tax rates, they're super low. And they're not going to stay this way forever for multiple reasons. One, because the current tax law is set to expire mid this decade. The other thing is just the liabilities that our government is facing. Well, they continue to grow and grow. And so anybody just kind of sitting on the sidelines, armchair quarterbacking, kind of knows the writing's on the wall that tax rates are going to have to go up. And so if you are able to take advantage of low tax rates now, pay the tax, and then allow that money to grow tax-free for years to come, well, then converting all the way over into a Roth IRA makes a whole lot of sense, I think.
Yeah, that's why we love the Roth, for sure. And also, I wanted to mention, too, make sure that when you do that rollover, Jamie, that you do a direct transfer as well, so that way it's going from custodian to custodian. That way you can avoid any potential penalties if you happen to sit on that check for too long. Yep. Just have it sent directly over to Fidelity if you're planning to go with them.
Yep, that is the worst of all possible scenarios. You get the check, you forget, you owe penalties and tax. That's not a good place to be in. All right, Matt, let's get into our next question about owing the IRS money.
Hello, my name is Michael, and I'm from San Antonio, Texas. Great podcast, and I look forward to each episode. I have a question about paying off debt. I'm currently paying off my debt using the debt snowball method. I'm highly motivated using this method and have paid off two credit cards in 2019. Recently, I was informed by the IRS that I did not pay enough taxes back in 2017, so I owe the IRS approximately $6,000. And I have requested the maximum amount of time to repay. I am waiting for a response. My two remaining credit cards have approximately $3,600 and $4,300 balances. So my question is, should I continue with my debt snowball method and continue aggressively paying down the credit card with the $3,600 balance, or should I refocus and aggressively pay off the IRS debt? So, what are your thoughts? Thanks.
Well, Michael, first, before we get to your question, let's just say a quick congrats to you on getting after your credit card debt using the debt snowball method. Like, that is just awesome that it's working for you. This is just more proof that it's not about the math. It's about the emotion of paying down debt and actually feeling like you're gaining some traction and making some progress. This is really valuable that it's allowed you to knock out a bunch of debt. However, the IRS isn't a regular creditor, so there are a few additional things that we want you to consider first.
Yeah, Matt, the IRS is different than any other creditor out there. And it's a bummer, Michael, that you're going to owe fees for failure to pay, but there's nothing you can do to change the past, to change what happened in 2017 with that return and that you didn't pay enough in tax. And depending on how much you owe and the way that your payment plan with the IRS is structured, well, it could add more penalties and more interest to your payoff amount. So make sure you're aware of the details and the finer points of your payoff plan. And that is all something to take into consideration as you continue with your debt snowball. Ultimately, the IRS is going to take top priority as to where you should kind of focus your attention in paying that debt off before you continue the debt snowball with your credit cards. And Matt, do you want to discuss why we think paying back the IRS is more important than paying off your credit cards?
Yeah, well, defaulting on the installment agreement is just terrible, and that can result in further penalties and interest. Quickly, it can outweigh any sort of interest that you'd be paying to a traditional credit card. So because of these penalties, that's why we feel that the IRS should be at the top of the list when it comes to paying back debts. And Michael, it sounds like you're already in touch with the IRS. You're in communication with them, and that's great. Since your balance is under $10,000, you should be able to qualify for that guaranteed installment agreement, which is Form 9465. you should choose to pay direct online so that you don't miss a payment and that you avoid paying those penalties and fees. It sounds like this is what you're doing. So if so, you're going the right direction.
Yeah, man, I agree. Choosing direct pay is so important because if you do accidentally forget, it slips your mind, you know, you are going to incur higher interest and more penalties. And that just prolongs the amount you have to pay. And it's just not good. You don't want to be in that position with the IRS. Let's talk about this too, Matt. There's something called an offer in compromise. And I don't think from hearing Michael that he qualifies for this, but it's just something worth putting out there. If for some reason paying this tax debt off would make it hard for you to live, like you have catastrophic health care expenses, or you don't have a job, you're in a true position of financial hardship, well, you can make an offer in compromise, which reduces the debt amount via a settlement with the IRS. And again, I don't think Michael's in this position to take advantage of an offer in compromise and try to reduce his overall debt amount that he owes the IRS. And he also owes only $6,000. But I just wanted to put that out there. It's an important thing for other people who might have, you know, bigger IRS debt issues to know.
Yeah, and one other side note too for other folks out there, if you can't pay your tax bill, you should still actually file your taxes. A failure to file results in even bigger penalties and can cause you to dig yourself into an even bigger hole. So you might have a problem, but don't put your head in the sand in an attempt to avoid it altogether. Michael, I know that if this was me, that I would want to get this tax debt off my back first and then get back to tackling those different credit cards by focusing on the card with the lowest balance first, since that's what you've been doing. That's, you know, what has worked for you. Again, we love the fact that you have found a method and a process that works for you. It's just that the IRS doesn't qualify as a standard debtor, right? Like they're not the standard credit card company. And so in this case, essentially what we're proposing is a modified debt snowball. I know you're not used to paying larger debts first because that's not how the debt snowball works. But in this one case, knock out that $6,000 owed to the IRS and then quickly get back to paying your smallest debts and let that snowball roll over on itself.
Yeah. And you know what, Matt? I know sometimes when people are hyper-focused on debt payoff, and then something like this can be a hurdle. It's one of those things that they didn't factor into their original debt snowball method, and it lengthens the timeline. And that can be really hard emotionally to kind of have that thing pop up. You're like, man, I'm doing good. And then this pops up. But Michael, like, keep the fervor, man, because you're making it happen. You are making progress. And you know what? This is a small hurdle. You're going to overcome this one, and you're going to keep crushing that debt snowball until, you know what? It's completely gone. It's completely eliminated. So you can do this. I hear it in your voice that you're ready to get after this debt and crush it as well.
So true, man. All right, we've got a couple more questions. We're going to talk about savings account rates, how they've been declining lately, and then we're going to get to that employee stock purchase plan. We're going to get to those right after the break.
All right, Matt, we're back from the break, and as anybody in our Facebook group knows, man, there's constant dismay about the fact that savings account rates continue to decline, and Neil has a question about that.
Hey guys, this is Neil calling from Los Angeles. I have some questions about high interest savings accounts online. About a year ago, I opened a Marcus account with Goldman Sachs at 2.25 interest. And over the last several months, that interest rate has gone down each month to where it is currently at 1.7%. So here are my questions. Number one, why is this happening? Number two, if or when can I expect rates to increase again? And three, is there a better place I can be storing my cash right now, keeping in mind that I need to keep it pretty liquid and accessible because I'll be returning to school in September and I'm going to be partially living off this money. Thank you, guys. I appreciate your time.
Oh, man. Great question, Neil. Thanks so much for leaving it. And it's a question on, like I said, a lot of people's minds. And you mentioned Marcus, man. That's a great savings account. They're offering rates that are competitive with the best online savings accounts out there. These rates are just in constant flux. So from day to day, they might be like top five, top 10, but they're offering really, really competitive rates. So
yeah, Marcus is solid.
Yeah, really good online bank. And I remember, Matt, when you could get a really good savings account. Back in my early days of savings, I remember having an account that paid me like 5.5%. That was pretty sweet. That's definitely not the case right now, right?
Yeah, I remember getting close to that with my ING Direct.
Yeah.
Orange savings.
The electric orange.
Yeah, I think that was the start of Capital One 360.
Yeah, they bought ING and because it was such a good product, and they've done a good job of keeping it pretty similar.
All right, let's get to the question. And Neil, I love how organized you were about what you're asking here. So the first question, why? Right? Why is this happening? And this is happening because the Federal Reserve, they've been lowering interest rates. They've done that a few times now over the past year. And that act basically stimulates the economy by making it easier for folks to borrow money, right? When there's cheap money that you can borrow, like that equals more borrowing, which means basically a kick in the pants to the economy. But what this does mean is that savers are getting hammered basically because rates are dropping, while borrowers are getting cheap long-term money basically.
Yeah, that, those mortgage rates, they're super low.
But super low.
So are the savings rates. You know? Yeah, so it is a both and. The other thing that you asked, Neil, was, well, when? When are low interest rates going to change? When are we going to be able to see higher rates on savings accounts? And here's what we think. We're definitely in a low interest rate environment currently, but it's not going to stay that way forever. Things are going to change. Interest rates will go up, but it's impossible to predict when that change is going to occur. Who knows what the Fed is going to do? And their actions have so much to do with savings accounts interest rates that we see in the market. And it's interesting because I think a lot of experts thought that interest rates on savings accounts would be higher right now. So would mortgage interest rates. Like, we would just see, as the economy did well, we would see rates continue to climb into kind of a more normal sphere. Because, for instance, mortgage rates are still hovering near all-time lows. But that hasn't been the case, despite a solid economy and despite record low unemployment numbers. I mean, they've continued to try to stimulate the economy through low interest rates, although that seems to be subsiding. And it's anybody's guess as to how long this will take. But I wouldn't bank on seeing, you know, that 5.5% interest rate that Matt and I talked about anytime in the next year or two.
But hopefully in our lifetime, at least, right? I would love to see just standard savings rates get back up to 5%. That would
I definitely see that happening.
Be sweet.
Yeah. I mean, like, these things, these economic cycles, they're cyclical. And so we will begin to see higher rates for savers. We'll see higher rates for borrowers. We'll have different economic circumstances to deal with.
Yep.
And you know what? There's kind of positives and negatives to each economic cycle we go through.
It ebbs and it flows, man. And then, Neil, the last part of your question, you're asking basically where else you could go to basically earn more, but to still have access to your funds, for your money to be liquid. Fact is, there is not a better place to go. Like, Marcus is pretty solid. But what you can do is you can consider snagging a sign-up bonus that can make your effective interest rate higher, right? Like CIT, Discover, they continue to have these nice little sign-up bonuses that sweeten the pot in addition to their competitive rates. CIT, they currently have, what is it right now, like a $300 bonus, Joel?
Yeah, if you've got 50 grand to put in there, and Neil, I'm not sure how much money we're talking about, but if you do have that much, you can get a $300 bonus. And if you've got 25 grand...
Just for putting your money in there.
Just for putting your money there, and I think having it there for 3 months. And actually, there was a discussion, Matt, recently on the Facebook group about kind of the hoops that you have to jump through in order to get some of these savings account bonuses. I kind of weighed in on the thread, and I said, I'm just only willing to take advantage of a savings account bonus if it doesn't involve all the additional hoops you have to jump through.
Like modified spending, all that kind of crap.
Exactly. Or they want you to change your direct deposit. So I'm not willing to do the hoops, but if it's super simple and straightforward and I can make a few $100 for moving my funds over to another bank for a short period of time, and that's kind of what Discover and CIT are doing. And so we'll post a link to those in our show notes. But if you've got a good sum of money and you want to earn more than you're currently earning, the online banks, they're getting so close into what they're offering. The percentage difference in interest rates that they're paying is so small. But the way that you can have kind of an outsized effect is to open a new one with a bank that's offering a sweet bonus.
Yeah, totally. Like, you don't want to change banks just to get a tenth of a percent higher interest rate. Like, that's not going to move the needle at all. But
right,
the sign-up bonuses, super solid. And Neil, also keep in mind too that even though you've dropped maybe from 1.85 down to 1.7 perhaps, that is still like 100 times better than a traditional brick and mortar savings account.
Sure.
And that's not even hyperbole. Literally, if you do the math, it's 100 times better probably within that range than the 0.02% that you're going to get at some of the big name banks. And so, yeah, like, it's dropping, but it is still substantially better than the traditional offerings.
No doubt. All right, Matt, let's get into our last question, our first ever foray into talking about employee stock purchase plans.
Hey guys, this is Todd from Atlanta, and I recently started a new job. My question is about employee stock purchase plans. With my new job, I have the option to participate in one of these plans, and I was wondering, what do you guys think of these plans in general, and where does something like an ESPP fall in the hierarchy of investing for you? You know, after recently listening to your episode on HSAs, clearly 401k match and HSA contributions should be at the top, but where does something like an ESPP come into play? Love what you guys do for the community and hope to run into y'all at a local brewery sometime. Take care.
Todd, if only this was a phone call and we could actually hear what some of your favorite local craft breweries are, that would be maybe fun, right? I guess that's not podcasting though. That's a It's a call-in show.
Yeah, that's the old school medium. And by the way, Matt, we just recently published an article on our site about our favorite breweries and bars in Atlanta. So for folks that live here or whether they're visiting, those are the spots that we're likely to hit up most often.
Man, what could be better? We're huge fans of Atlanta. We're huge fans of craft beer. So you combine those two. Of course, this is going to be something we talk about. Just sprinkle in a little bit of money and that's our podcast. Let's go ahead and get to Todd's question. He's talking about the ESPP. And again, that stands for an employee stock purchase plan. So for folks who don't know what an ESPP is, some employers, they offer an employee benefits and you can buy your company's stock at a discount, sometimes up to 15% off, that's a great deal. ESPPs can offer some other interesting benefits as well, like these different look-back provisions that allow you to buy the stock at its lowest recent share price. And so it's almost like a double discount where not only are you getting it on sale, regardless of the price, the actual price of it fluctuates and you get to kind of tag it at the low point. So that is just so sweet.
Yeah, you said double discount. Made me think of that State Farm commercial, the discount double check. It's kind of got that thing going on, right? You got this double discount possibility with the ESPP by having this ability to purchase at a really low share price and also just getting that often 15% discount. That's pretty sweet.
Yeah, it's a great deal, dude. It makes me think of, you were thinking about the commercial. I'm thinking about this corn dog place that used to be in Atlanta, and they would double fry their corn dogs.
Oh, there you go.
So it was like twice fried. Twice is nice. So.
Twice is good, man. I'm with you on that. All right, but we should also talk about the risks that ESPPs post. And the biggest issue that we have with ESPPs is that it can cause you to focus your investing strategy around buying company stock. And ultimately, if you're doing that, you're putting too many eggs into one basket. Your income already comes from your employer. Should your retirement assets be riding on employer performance too? Probably not. So basically, what you want to avoid is buying and holding your employer stock for the long term. That's a recipe for too much risk.
Yeah, well, Joel, we're going to talk about how to actually use an ESPP. But, you know, you mentioned risk and you mentioned how our income is tied to our employer, obviously. So a lot of people are way too invested in the companies, you know, who they work for.
Yeah, they own stock in that company. And if you own too much, not a good idea.
Yeah, exactly. But even on top of that as well, for a lot of smaller towns where there's a large company there, a company like that can have a huge impact on the local real estate. And so for a lot of people, they have a lot of their money, a lot of their assets tied up in their home. And so, man, when so much is riding on the performance of that company, because guess what? What if that factory closes or that headquarters decides to relocate and go somewhere else? Well, all of a sudden, you know, your income's dropping. Maybe they're not performing as well, so your portfolio is dropping. But guess what? The cherry on top, your home's now worth less because everybody is leaving town. So, you know, tying too much of your assets to a single company like that is the opposite of diversification.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think it's something that people don't think about much, that depending on where you live, your company might have a big impact on the overall local economy. I mean, I think the perfect example is a factory closing in a small town. And most of those jobs are completely tied to that factory, and the whole local economy revolves around that one business. And so, yeah, if that business shutters its doors or if that business moves overseas, you're talking about this potential for extreme financial trouble to you and your family based on just that one employer. And that's just one reason, but there are other reasons too, that you don't want to have too much of your financial resources weighed so heavily towards the performance of your employer.
Yeah. And, Todd, he's here in Atlanta like we are. Atlanta is a pretty large city, so it's less likely that that's the case for him. But for everyone else out there who is listening and they do have that as an option, definitely keep that in mind. If you do choose to participate, it is important to sell that employer stock soon after you're eligible. Joel, you just mentioned how, you know, we don't want to buy and hold for the long term. You want to do the opposite. You want to sell as soon as you can. Some folks recommend holding on to that stock even longer, you know, for a preferred tax treatment, but that puts you at unnecessary risk. If the discount is solid, right, if it's close to maybe 15%, and you can be a disciplined seller, then it makes sense to take that discount and sell your purchases when you're allowed. Then you're avoiding most of that risk that comes with holding loads of company stock.
Yeah, Matt, I think a question that might arise in someone's mind who hasn't really heard of ESPPs, or they just know very little, they haven't heard much about them, is, well, that kind of sounds like working the system. You're buying your company stock at a discount, and then you're selling it as soon as possible. Well, isn't that kind of messed up? Well, not really, because an ESPP is a recognized benefit, and there are caps for employees on how much they can take advantage of this benefit. So the IRS caps the limit at $25,000 overall. That's the most amount of money that you're able to use to buy employer stock with an ESPP. And most employers have a cap as well, 15% of your salary. So let's say you make 50 grand a year. Typically, the most amount of company stock you can purchase is $7,500. But this is another great benefit that some companies offer. And if you use it well and you're not putting yourself at undue risk, well, it's not gaming the system. What it is it's taking advantage of an employer benefit and using it to maximum effectiveness for your financial life.
And then lastly, Todd, you're asking, what should the hierarchy be? Like, what should come first? And if you have the money to do all of the different types of retirement investing, then do them all, right? An ESPP is a great benefit and one that you can use effectively to build wealth. But do make sure that you're taking a balanced approach. You don't want to get too lopsided. Obviously, a 401k match is of the highest importance. HSAs are a great second option if they're available, just like you mentioned. But then after that, consider an ESPP. I think that's a great spot where they could slot into your retirement savings.
Yeah, man. I think the more money you have overall that you can invest, the more likely you should be taking advantage of investing in your ESPP. I'm a fan of the all of the above approach, choosing D and saying, you know what, I'm going to put money in all these things in my 401k up to the match, the HSA, a good bit in there, and then also taking advantage of the employee stock purchase plan.
Option D, that was Joel's default multiple choice answer.
Why I did so poorly in school, buddy. And yeah, man, I think really if you are able to prioritize the 401k and the HSA first, and you're able to put a good bit of money in there, well, then that lowers your risk level too, because you're more widely diversified. You're not putting all of your eggs in that employer stock basket. And we would say, especially if you're able to get the really sweet discount, if your employer is offering that super generous discount of something like 15% on your purchases, and Todd, you're able to be disciplined in selling those shares once you're first able to, I think it's a no-brainer to take advantage of your ESPP, at least in part.
Yeah. And again, what we're talking about here, like the plan and the approach that we take with the ESPP, is that you're utilizing and making money off of the discount structure of, you know, scoring an ESPP. You're not making money by holding onto the stock and watching the, you know, your Coca-Cola stock soar, you know, if that's the case. That might happen, but it also may not happen. But what's guaranteed is that you know that you are getting that discount right now. And that's what we're focusing on.
Yeah. And if you sell them quickly, you're locking in the discount, making that spread. And then the long-term money that you have invested for retirement is widely diversified.
Way less risk.
Right. In index funds, ETFs that offer way less risk because they're invested in hundreds and hundreds of companies as opposed to just one.
Exactly. You know, I mentioned Coca-Cola, but they are here in Atlanta. And I wonder if he does work for Coke.
Ooh.
There's a real possibility of that.
Todd, let us know if you work for Coke.
What if Coke comes out with Coke Clear?
Like Pepsi did back in the day?
Yeah.
Oh, so seriously, my neighbor
That's when the stock's going to tank and the ESPP is not going to be so pretty.
So my neighbor across the street, he worked for Pepsi growing up. And I remember getting one of the first bottles of Pepsi Clear. And I was like, this is amazing.
No way.
Yeah. This is
the soda of the future.
It didn't last long. But it was cool.
Coca-Cola Clear and Dippin' Dots.
As a small child, you're like, I've never seen soda that's clear.
Yeah.
But yeah.
You know, one of my favorite variations on Coke was Coke Black. With a K?
Yeah. Was that the coffee infused?
Yeah, exactly.
I never even had it.
What?
Was it good?
Yes, it was good.
I don't know how I missed it.
Dude, that was back in like 06 maybe. I really liked it.
They need to re-release that because I would totally drink it.
Well, on that note, we're drinking a beer currently that has coffee notes infused in it. We are drinking Mexican Chocolate Yeti, which is an Imperial Stout by Great Divide. Joel, you want to share your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I love the Yeti beers, and they've got all these variants now. Mexican Chocolate Yeti did not disappoint. It had these really subtle Mexican spices going on in the background. Some of them stuck out more than others. I would say there was a good bit of cinnamon, a touch of chili pepper. Ultimately, Matt, I wish we were podcasting and drinking this beer around a campfire outside because it feels like the perfect beer for campfire sipping. This was really tasty. I really enjoyed it.
Well, on that note, they sent us a bunch of beers, and one of the other ones we're going to have by them is, I think it's a S'mores Yeti. So speaking of sitting around the campfire, I think you already burned that line, so you're not going to be able to use that next time we have that.
Well, maybe we'll just actually have to do that and podcast outside. How do you feel about that?
I'm fine with that, dude.
All right.
Well, this beer, it poured super dark, and it had a really dark caramel brown head, and it just completely set the tone. When you pour it, you look at it, you know what that beer is going to taste like. It's going to taste dark. And I'm with you. It had super cinnamony notes going on, but then you drink it and it's got those coffee tones as well. It's a little sweet. And it had that tiny touch of heat in the back of it. It wasn't overwhelming. There's a beer, Joel, that we have here locally that you mentioned in your local brewery article. And they have a similar stout, but sometimes they load it up with heat. I'm talking so hot that you can't even almost finish the beer. Like that happened to me one time because it changes every single month. And this was not the case. It just had a little kiss of that heat. It made it interesting, kept me coming back for more, but at the same time didn't completely blow me away with spice.
Yeah, no doubt, man. This was good. Big thanks to our friends at Great Divide for sending this beer our way. All right, Matt, that's going to do it for this episode. If you want to submit a listener question to be considered for a future episode, go to howtomoney.com/ask. And if you just want to read the beer article I wrote or find previous episodes, just go to howtomoney.com and start poking around.
Well, and Joel, you know, the reason we host this podcast, and especially too, the reason we take listener questions is we want to be able to help people when it comes to their personal finances. If you haven't left us a review yet, you could help other people who have not found this podcast. You could help them find this podcast and to learn ways that they could better their financial situation. Just head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review there. And you can subscribe wherever it is that you listen to your podcast so you don't miss an episode. So Joel, that's going to be it, buddy. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.